Rabies is still a worldwide disease.
Once the signs of rabies emerge in a human, the case fatality, that is the number of people who develop those symptoms that go on to die, is really 100%.
World Rabies Day is September 28th. My guests today will highlight the impact of rabies and talk about their work with Rabies Free Africa. I will let them introduce themselves.
I'm Christy Cotterill, Development Director for the WSU College of Veterinary Medicine and Rabies Free Africa.
Yes, my name is Guy Palmer. I'm a professor of pathology and infectious diseases at Washington State University, where I serve as the Director of Global Health. And in that role, I also serve as the director of Rabies Free Africa.
And this is Louise Sabeel with Radio Tacoma. And I am so pleased to be talking with both Christy Cotterill and Dr. Guy Palmer. World Rabies Day, when did that start? I don't remember that when I was in vet school.
That's a good question. I actually don't know the answer to that. You know, probably sometime in about the last 10 years, I would say, and I'm just going by that because that's about when the momentum began to really eliminate all human deaths due to rabies.
An admirable goal. What's involved with World Rabies Day? I mean, why have a day? You know, is it in support of rabies? Are we looking to encourage rabies?
I think we're there to discourage rabies as a whole. Part of it is just to raise awareness of the fact that I think one of our challenges is our own country here in the U.S., but all of, including Canada, most of Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, have done a remarkable job in controlling rabies to the point that we really don't think of it anymore as a disease. Certainly there's a rare case of a bat or something that may be in the newspaper, but as a society, we don't think of this as still a major disease problem. Yet worldwide, there are somewhere between 60,000 and 100,000 individuals who die of rabies. Almost all of that's due to dog bites, and that occurs every year. So part of it is to raise awareness, but also part of it is to galvanize change.
So from what I understand, there is a project in Africa that is going strong.
So most of the rabies cases in humans today occur in sub-Saharan Africa and also in South and East Asia. We have really focused on Africa just to concentrate our efforts to eliminate human rabies deaths in the continent. So we've worked with multiple groups. It's not simply a matter of, for example, Washington State University or Rabies Free Africa as an NGO to go in and eliminate the problem. It's really to work across the whole of society, governments, humane societies, private veterinarians, government veterinarians, to make sure that we get dogs vaccinated, and then to work with the human health sector to make sure that those individuals who are exposed to rabies get the care that they need. As you would know, and as many people realize, it's very important to get treatment if somebody is bitten by a rabid dog. Once the signs of rabies emerge in a human, the case fatality, that is the number of people who develop those symptoms that go on to die, is really 100%. So getting that care, and so integrating what we do to make sure all the dogs are vaccinated with the human healthcare sector to make sure that people get the post-exposure prophylaxis when they need it is essential.
I tell people with pride that I've been vaccinated for rabies. And I know that was something that happened in veterinary school. It was like this program. And I had, and this is a question that I don't know if you can answer or not, because before I got into vet school and was working in the veterinary field, I was actually vaccinated with a duck embryo vaccine. And then in vet school, they had the human diploid. And I don't even really know what that means.
Well, it's a, so the rabies vaccination has a long history, actually. Pasteur obviously invented the first rabies vaccine, which was just really made from a very crude preparation of central nervous system tissue that had rabies virus in it, was inactivated, vaccinated an individual, and it worked. So you can make a rabies vaccine many ways. What's happened over the years is refinement of those to decrease any side effects in people that get immunized. So the duck embryo, which you originally got and it was very common, a lot of people would have an allergic reaction to that. Mm. Not life-threatening, but swollen arms, transient fever, that made it kind of an unpleasant experience. Because many people are actually allergic to parts of poultry eggs or poultry feathers, those kind of things, which some of those compounds were in the duck embryo vaccine, The human diploid is basically just a human cell line. So therefore the virus is grown in a human cell line, harvested from that, inactivated, and then use that as the immunogen. And because it's human tissue, it doesn't have the same allergic response that the duck embryo had. So it's much easier on the people who are vaccinated today than when you got it.
Yeah. So this was a long time ago and my memory's not so good, but I was told that this would be a lifelong vaccine, but would only need a booster if I had exposure.
That's the recommendation for people who are not at high risk, is because you do get the immunization. Now, if you're continuing to be at high risk, revaccination is also encouraged. But because you have been vaccinated, if you were to be exposed to a known rabid dog, they can just treat you with the post-exposure immunization because your immune system has been primed.
So is that the reason that dogs require the rabies vaccine every 3 years?
The reason that the schedule we use for dogs is most dogs are going to develop a very strong, what's called the neutralizing antibody response, which is what we use as the measure for their ability to be protected. Most dogs that are vaccinated and then boosted are probably going to be protected for the rest of their life. So why do we revaccinate them? Mm-hmm. The key word there was probably. Probably is not very good for a 100% fatal disease. Mm-hmm. So we have to make decisions based on knowing that a dog has been vaccinated and revaccinated. We have to be 100% sure of that when we're dealing with a 100% fatal illness. And we have to make a decision whether to do post-exposure prophylaxis or not. And if we know that dog has been vaccinated and revaccinated, then we have the certainty to make a medical decision that, yes, we do not have to treat the individual for post-exposure prophylaxis. So in one way, people can argue it's a little bit of a excessive vaccination of the individual dog, but it's without adverse side effects for the dog and with tremendous benefits in terms of protecting public health.
Yeah, good point. So what about dogs that aren't vaccinated? If they have a known exposure, what happens to them?
So if dogs, we do a very good job of dog vaccination here in North America. So that's something that not only the veterinary profession, but also public health and dog owners could be very proud of, to the degree that we've really eliminated what's called the canine variant of rabies virus. We don't see it at all circulating in the population. So that actually really reduces our risk of rabies here. That's not what happens in the rest of the world, where we have a significant number of unvaccinated dogs. And with an unvaccinated dog, obviously, it can be bitten by a rabid dog, Now it becomes rabid, and you can see how that chain then continues.
Yeah, I've read some fictional accounts, but very moving accounts of people who are dying of rabies and, you know, what they go through. And it's horrific. And as you say, it's 100% fatal.
It is. There have been only a very few known survivors of rabies, most of whom have severe mental defects for the rest of their life. Only a very few have ever recovered and been what we would call cognitively normal.
Yeah.
So if it's not 100%, it's 99.999% fatal.
Right. Another question that I've had people ask me, there are a number of people who like to own wolf hybrids. And from my understanding, that if they're vaccinated, legally, it's not really seen as a vaccination. Do you have anything to say about wolf
hybrids? Well, only that vaccines are approved for use in a specific species. And so when you have something that is no longer, the species in which that vaccine has been tested and proven to be effective, you can no longer at that point say you have that level of confidence. It's just like using any unapproved vaccine or treatment.
So we're getting into World Rabies Day. But then what about Washington State? What is the state of rabies in Washington? I know that a couple of decades ago, there was a little girl that was bitten by a bat in her sleep and died.
Yeah, well, we're very lucky in the state of Washington in that we don't have what's called terrestrial rabies. We do not have rabies circulating certainly not in our dog population, but also not in our wild carnivore populations either. So we're very fortunate in that way that we don't have that. So the only rabies cases that we do see, which are very few in the state of Washington, are from bats. That said, one thing Rabies Free Africa has done is worked with veterinarians and veterinary clinics throughout the state of Washington. So even though we don't have endemic rabies, what we do have is a very socially aware global health community in the state of Washington who have really been the leaders in supporting Rabies Free Africa. Christy may have shared this with you already, but we have a large number of veterinary clinics concentrated probably on the west side of the state in Puget Sound, but also extending not only in Washington, but through many other states, that for every rabies vaccination they give, they donate a dollar to Rabies Free Africa so that we can vaccinate dogs for those families that cannot afford to have their dogs vaccinated.
And so from what I read on the website, there's kind of a push this month in celebration of World Rabies Day.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have Christy jump in there. But I think for us, it's just a focal point to, one, thank and re-energize those veterinarians and other individuals who are contributing to the program. And also it's an effort to bring on new ones, to increase that awareness. And to say, as a profession and as a profession that serves globally aware dog owners, this is something we can do. We can eliminate human rabies deaths. So it really puts the focus on, this is not a goal with no end in sight. This is an achievable goal, but we need engagement to make that happen. Christy, do you want to jump in on anything with that?
Yeah. So in September, we are focusing our efforts for World Rabies Day under a campaign that we're calling the Rabies Hero campaign. And like I mentioned, there's a couple reasons for that. The first one is, as everybody knows, 2020 is different, unique, and has been hard for a lot of people, veterinarians included. Most veterinary clinics have had to drastically alter how they can offer care, which has shifted a lot of care to animals that need high levels of specific needs.
I have a cat that had to go in for surgery. You know, I absolutely get it. What has been missing is that primary wellness care for and vaccines for rabies, parvovirus, distemper, etc. So for September, what we are doing is we are giving clinics a toolkit so they can organize what we are calling vaccination clinics. This doesn't mean bringing 100 people to a specific spot because that's not safe right now because of COVID-19, but instead kind of shifting how marketing is done and shifting a focus for this month to try to get their regular clients and others in the community up to date on their vaccines so that we don't have a secondary public health outbreak in our animals communities that the reality is most communities right now can barely sustain what they're doing, and adding a secondary health outbreak is going to be really hard. Most veterinary clinics are, small businesses. They don't have a lot of money for creating marketing campaigns. They don't have a lot of resources. We have done that. So we have stuff that they can copy, paste, promote, bring their clients in, vaccinate animals. Let's get these animals healthy before the end of the year. At the same time, we are talking about the bigger global cause that Guy mentioned of the almost 60,000 people a year who die from rabies because their dogs they either don't have access to the vaccine, they can't afford the vaccine, or there's not enough education in the community for them to understand the value of vaccinating, for rabies versus something for their child if they have limited resources. So for us this year, we're able to kind of do a both and everybody can find information about it at rabiesforafrica.org.
Could you repeat that website?
Yes, rabiesfreeafrica.org.
Thank you. Well, this is so important. Thank you.
Can I add one quick other thing too?
Yes,
it's actually
please.
To a previous question that you answered, but we were asking about revaccinating every 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that we have talked about before is, there's a very different set of reality for people who live in the United States and other developed countries versus the developing world. The lifespan of a dog in East Africa is 4 years max. And so if we go through every year and vaccinate, we are revaccinating, like the number of animals that we see are brand new, or a quarter to maybe a third of the animals in a community are brand new and have never gotten a rabies vaccine. So when you're talking about a 3-year arc for revaccinating, it's a different conversation to have here in the States, where almost everybody that walks past the street with their dog has probably taken their animal in maybe a couple times, 3 times, depending on the age of their animal, versus in Africa, where over a couple year window, maybe a 3-year window, we aren't seeing repeat animals at all. And so it's a very different conversation.
So again, from what I was taught, the first vaccine is good for a year and then you boost in a year. So it sounds like in Africa, they're getting that first vaccine, but not the booster. Is that correct?
Yes. So what we've found is, and again, it comes back to this public health issue, is when you vaccinate a dog the first time, about 93% of them go ahead and convert to what we call the protective titer. So we actually protect a really large number of them with just one vaccination. And then if they're boosted, in many of these villages, traditionally, this model of annual vaccination campaigns, they wouldn't be boosted again for another year. But we've been looking at ways to shift that model so basically what we try to get is, we try to vaccinate 70% of the dogs in the population. By vaccinating 70%, you actually block the chain of transmission, even though you still have some dogs that are not vaccinated. Mm-hmm. Just like, with measles, you have to vaccinate over 90% of children to block it. It's about 70% for dogs. But you can imagine in an annual vaccination campaign, what happens is, let's say we hit 70% today, but a week from now, it's also going to be decreasing because some of our vaccinated dogs may die and puppies are born. So your population, you begin to lose the 70% over that next year. So we've been working on a new model where we actually keep the vaccines in the community. And so then there's a local individual who identifies new puppies being born, and then they have a livestock officer come out and vaccinate those dogs. So we're able to keep that level of immunity up much higher. Now, to do that, one of the keys that we had to do was find a way to store vaccines in places that don't have electrical power or refrigeration. Mm-hmm. So the first thing we did is we established, could a vaccine maintain being effective if kept at certain temperatures? And we found that you can keep vaccines for 3 months at 30 degrees centigrade, which is actually pretty hot. And then we had to develop a simple cooling system, which is a clay pot with some moist sand in the bottom. And we make those locally in Tanzania and have found that you can maintain those below 26 degrees so the vaccine stays good for 3 months, even when the ambient temperature is over 40. So it does two things. It allows us to have this continual vaccination, so we're able to maintain the population immunity at this high level above 70%. And the second thing it does is it really transfers the responsibility for vaccination to the community itself, which is the only way it's going to be sustained.
Now, something you said kind of triggered a question, because you mentioned, you know, the livestock handlers coming in to vaccinate the dogs, which reminds me that all mammals pretty much are susceptible to rabies, which would include horses, cattle, goats, all of them. So how does that figure in?
So you can see rabies obviously in other species. Again, that's usually due though to transmission is by dog bites. Mm-hmm. So it allows us, by focusing on the dog population, we're able to keep it out of the livestock population as well as obviously the human population. So really the dog is the focus of vaccination.
So you don't get rabid horses running around biting people?
No, they are generally an end host, if you will. They do not really transmit it.
Yeah. Which reminds me, gosh, just this week, my brother-in-law found a baby squirrel that was kind of comatose, and he brought it home and it was pretty young, so he was bottle feeding it and raising it like a kitten. And I had to go and look it up, and I didn't mention this to him, but my concern was, what about rabies in squirrels?
Squirrels can get rabies. Again, they're not one that commonly transmit it. They're generally an end host, again, because if you think of dogs as being, or other even wild carnivores being kind of the ones likely to transmit it to a squirrel, the squirrel usually loses that battle.
So they basically die before they can transmit.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So I suppose that's a good thing. But with dogs, they can run around for quite a while being sick.
They can. Obviously, they can transmit to multiple people as well as to other dogs. Most dogs, actually, that do get infected, fortunately, most dogs don't transmit either to another dog or to a person. Most of them go off and die on their own. But that said, it just takes one rabid dog biting multiple children to give you a real public health tragedy.
And then there's the issue of cats, because with cats, you know, they're out hunting and sick bats are easily caught. Is that the way that the rabies would get into the population in that manner, through the bat to the cat?
It could, again, and cats do get rabies. There's no question they do. They can get it either from a bat. They can get it from a dog. There's not a lot of dog-cat transmission, as you would imagine, because it's a little bit like the squirrel. The cat tends to lose that, you know, in a fight with a rabid dog, the cat tends to lose. But you do see rabies in cats, then they can transmit it to people. So in our vaccination campaigns that we do in Africa, we do vaccinate cats. That's a real challenge because most cats there are not, even though they live with a family, they're not handled quite in the same way that we might think of handling our cats. So when picked up, it's a bit of a tussle.
Are bats in Africa endemic with rabies?
You do see rabies in bats, but again, that's a very small percentage of the problem. There are obviously individual human health tragedies when you have a bat transmit to somebody unknowingly and someone gets rabies. There's very few cases of that, usually zero to maybe a very few in North America in a given year versus the high range of, you know, in the tens of thousands of people due to dog bite rabies. It's important to emphasize that in rabies-free Africa and in the plan, and the goal is to eliminate human deaths due to rabies worldwide, we're not eradicating the virus from the face of the earth. That's important to emphasize because it will still circulate in bats. It will circulate to a small degree in wild carnivores. We just want to eliminate the impact on human health. And in doing so also on the majority of domestic animal health as well.
So it's not like smallpox.
Yes. We're not going to eliminate the virus. What we're going to do is we're going to reduce the transmission to humans by mass dog vaccination. And then we're going to ensure that those individuals who are exposed to either a known rabid dog or an unknown rabid dog when there's no knowledge of the vaccination status, or in the rare cases that it's from a wild animal or from a bat, that those individuals have access to appropriate post-exposure prophylaxis, the treatment that prevents development of rabies in the victim.
It sounds like what you're really doing is you're focusing on the things that you can do, rather than trying to do everything.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. We've got a very clear focus, and you know, we have a lot of advantages in that we have a vaccine that works. We have a population of people who don't want rabies in their animals. What we need just to do is find ways to do that in the most efficient way possible. So again, things such as storing vaccines locally with very low cost, low tech cooling devices. So the community actually engages in it. And also that the government sees this as something that the various governments that we work with in Africa, that they see this as, yes, this is something that can be accomplished. It's not a never ending battle. It's not Sisyphus pushing the rock up the hill and having it roll back down on him every time. That's really important that there's an end goal and that this can be accomplished.
Yeah.
So I would add that one of the big focus for our program is that we, you know, employ people from the communities to do the work. And we do that because they understand the cultural nuances. They speak the language. A lot of times programs are set up differently and there can be varying levels of success. But because the people who work in our program, our staff and our researchers for the most part are from those communities, we're helping build up the capacity in the different countries that we work in, as well as they're the ones who are going to understand, you know, the nuances of working with their own local, regional, and national governments and how to get communities involved. You know, for example, the team that works in Tanzania was telling me how they get dogs when they do the Central Point vaccination clinics is they go through the day before with a bullhorn announcing that there's going to be a vaccination clinic tomorrow, 2 hours after sunrise, let's say. And the next day at sunrise, before the time, you have all of these kids lined up with their dogs, or they're coming in with their dogs, and it's the kids that bring it. And so then in Kenya, what they had to do is they had to make sure to organize the clinics during school breaks because if they did it during school, the kids are the ones who are bringing the dogs, and so the campaigns weren't effective. And by having people who live there, who understand the cultural nuances, we can create these programs that are much more effective than if, say, I was to go, I would have, you know, like, I work on social media most of the time and on a computer, right? That's not going to be effective at all to the communities that we're serving.
Yeah, that's so important because, you know, there's only so much success you can have from a top-down structure. It has to be from the people who are experiencing that in their daily lives.
Yeah, I think the one, I'm going to say advantage, it's a tragic advantage in a way, is that these communities know about rabies. It's something very real to them. They've known people who have had lost somebody in their family due to rabies. It's not a foreign concept. It's something that's very important to them.
I'm interested too in talking with the veterinarians that you had mentioned in Kenya and Tanzania?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Those are the places that we work most directly. Mm-hmm. We work more broadly with across sub-Saharan Africa, but we do that through partners. The ones that we are most, where we're actually doing our campaigns and doing our field trials to find more effective ways to deliver vaccines, are in East Africa, countries of Kenya and especially Tanzania.
Well, I look forward to talking with them too and finding out how it is on the ground.
Sure. I'm sure Christy can get you connected with our veterinarians there. Especially I would recommend Dr. Lancaster for that.
Well, wonderful. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to add?
I don't know that, I'll let Christy finish, but I guess one thing is just how grateful we are to the engagement of veterinarians here in the state of Washington, because who really led it? It's really started out with leadership out of the Puget Sound. Mm-hmm. And it's now spread. It's spreading increasingly across the country because they don't necessarily suffer from rabies in their own communities, but every veterinarian is an expert on rabies. They are a tremendous source of knowledge. They understand its impact. And they engage then with their clientele. And we've just been really impressed by the way that they have adopted this campaign, made it their own, and continue with it. It's not a one-off thing. It's something I think we feel that we're all in it together to try to accomplish this end goal of eliminating human suffering due to rabies.
Christy, did you want to add something?
I think what I would add is that, as I mentioned before, this year is very unique and different. And by being involved with Rabies Free Africa and the Rabies Hero Program this September, beyond veterinarians showing that they are part of this greater global health cause to improve the health of both animals and pets, there's also a very unique opportunity this year to be highly engaged in their communities. You know, the last thing we want is people to have to choose that between their pet and food on their table, and then relinquish pets into shelters that aren't even open at full capacity and have a hard time readopting the animals out. And so by being involved in this program, by, you know, offering some free vaccines to maybe some of their clients or discounts or working with their local shelter, you know, in King County, we have four different nonprofits and shelters that are working together for World Rabies Day to offer multi-site vaccination clinics so that people who are lost their jobs, who are low income, who are experiencing homelessness, can find a place that they can get their pets vaccinated and keep them with it. It helps with mental health challenges. It helps with the emotional support, and it helps keep our communities together. And by working together, we can keep our communities strong as we are working through how to get past this COVID-19 pandemic.
So one last question. When is World Rabies Day?
World Rabies Day every year is September 28th. So this year it is a Monday, but people should probably be on the lookout for activities the weekend before, which would be September 26th and 27th. Most of the clinics I've talked to are trying to do something over that weekend.
Thank you.
All right, super. Well, thank you.
Yes, thank you so much. This has been great.
Yes, thank you. And I have reached out to Dr. Lancaster, just so that you know, and we're figuring out the right, with the time zones, the right time. So I
know,
I
know.
Follow up with you on some dates.
I get up at 3 a.m.
This has been a conversation with Christy Cotterill and Dr. Guy Palmer, who work with Rabies Free Africa. This conversation will continue with those on the ground in East Africa and with the perspective of a local veterinarian. Thank you for joining us. Stay safe.